You're listening to a special extended podcast version of Panel Borders. I'm Alex Fitch, and this interview was partially broadcast on Resonance FM as part of their weekly show about the world of comics. In this podcast, continuing a series of shows about anthropomorphic or funny animal comics, I'm talking to David Peterson about his series of adventure comics and graphic novels, Mouse Guard. First, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
I was reading on the Wikipedia page for you, which doesn't necessarily mean that it's true, that you started off doing children's books for your family. Was it an ambition that you felt you needed to sort of work up a portfolio of children's book illustrations before you could do it professionally?
To some degree, yeah. I mean, I was thinking children's books would probably be the profession for me. In high school, I wanted to do comics, but I was looking at what I saw in modern comics, and I didn't see anything that looked like the kind of artwork I did. So I just didn't really think I'd be suited for it. And in college, was aiming more towards children's book illustration. I sent out some samples of my work, some stuff to try to get some work out of. And I got one rejection letter and 20 plus, you know, silence, nothing.
Okay.
Where they didn't give any attempt to even reply. So I mean I just kept going about my regular routine. I was working, you know, the jobs that people work in between college and what ends up being their real job. I worked at an ice cream store. I worked at a coffee shop. I worked at an antique store. All the while, just kind of thinking, well, I'll make these things, and they'll give me practice, and it'll give me a better portfolio, because you don't keep sending out the same material.
Sure.
So that's why I was kind of pursuing that thing. I was thinking this would give me a little bit better practice. A lot of the subject matter in that first portfolio wasn't necessarily children's book oriented, so I thought, well, if I just make some children's books on my own, that'd be a better portfolio than what I set out the first time.
Because you studied printmaking at college, and certainly I'm not entirely sure what technique you used to do Mouse Guard, and we can discuss that in a bit, but there does seem to be an element of lithography and printmaking in the way that you construct an image, from the cross-hatching that you use in the background of an image to the use of light and shade.
Yeah, I think printmaking was really informative in what I end up doing. It was something that I fell into because I really liked the professor.
Mm-hmm.
He was my 2D design professor, which is like a first semester art basics kind of a class. And I just really liked the guy. I felt like I clicked with him. He was good at explaining things, and I wanted to take any other class he was offering. Printmaking kind of changed the way I drew, not just in the techniques with the line quality and that sort of thing, but also printmaking is a very non-direct way of making an image. Unlike almost any of the other methods of making art when you're in school, you know, if it's textiles or sculpture or painting or whatever, most of the time there's a good amount of time where your hands are on the final art image that everybody's going to see. You're physically manipulating the end product. With printmaking, you spend almost all of your time working on a plate that ends up being what makes the final image, not the actual final image. So everything you're working on is in metal. Well, if it's matching, you're working in metal, and you're working with all these chemicals and dropping it into the acid and polishing the metal and scraping the metal, or if it's wood, you're carving the wood and maybe sanding the wood, maybe using wood filler, all these different kind of things that has nothing to do with what the final thing on paper is actually going to be. I mean, you're definitely working on the artwork, but there's a couple steps removed from that final piece where you're not physically working on it. That means you have to be all the time thinking about how to get a final image. Like it's mirrored for one.
Yeah.
So like that's lesson one. you have to be thinking almost dyslexically. But yeah, there's so many other things about your process and all the different techniques that you can use to try to get what would be the final image. So which of those techniques do you use where? What part of that do you have to do first, second, third? Because if you do them out of order, you can get different results. So as much as it was about learning about line quality and tone and some rendering techniques, it was also about thinking in advance what the final image was going to be before you even started.
Mm. And is that something that kind of honed your craft in the sense that now that you're making comics, they're images that are mass produced and so have a sort of a longevity and a shelf life. And obviously when you're making prints, you're working towards a similar kind of end product. Does that lead to some kind of discrepancy between having an image that has some movement to it, but also an image that you know can be reproduced on numerous pieces of paper?
I mean, yeah, I guess. I think that printmaking is more about, for me, about the line quality. What I took out of it for comics was more about line quality and tone and width of shading, and then also the way I think about an image.
Mm.
I think, you know, with comics, you can kind of do what you want, whether you're doing drawings and ballpoint pen on a napkin and making that work as a comic. You know, if you're a talented artist, you can do that.
Mm.
You can pull that off. If you're sculpting individual sculptures and then photographing them under the lighting circumstances and making that into a comic, you know, that can be done as well. And so no matter what you're doing, it still has to read. It has to read well. You have to be able to have that kind of movement, that kind of life to the characters. Otherwise, it just feels flat.
Mm.
Same, just straight up drawing.
In other interviews with you, I've read that you said that Frank Miller and Mike Mignola were influences on your work. And I didn't see it quite so much at first reading Mouse Guard. But as the darker elements come into the saga, such as the black armour that the rival faction of mice wears, and then the underground caverns full of bones in the second series, I could see that dark fantasy is obviously an influence, but at the same time you use the sort of traditional, almost Victorian children's book illustrations, but then weave in this very modern way of telling fantasy stories.
Yeah, Miller I chose as an influence because of the way he is good at two-dimensional design.
Mm.
He's really clever about patterning white and black spaces to become a shape rather than drawing things with line. And to that degree, Mignola is also. They're both shape guys. Whereas I tend to be more of a line person, but I like to try to think in terms of shapes, or at least in terms of groupings of shapes to move the reader's eye through something. And I'll think of the shapes as being collections of different line patterns or line densities. So that's kind of where I'm getting the influence, at least from Miller, is more from a 2D design aspect. Mignola, yeah, it goes deeper than that. It goes into his storytelling as well. And things like the what you mentioned with the kind of darker imagery that's at the same time tame.
Mm-hmm.
And accessible. Even when Mignola does pretty gory and graphic material, it never looks graphic to me. I mean, there's definitely a spookiness and everything. Like, it's not as though he's taken any of the edge away. He's just taken away the skin crawling aspect of it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I totally respect that.
And are there any children's book illustrators who also influenced you? Because on your blog, I see that you've illustrated an image from The Winds and the Willows. And certainly the idea of having animal and anthropomorphic characters in children's literature stretches right back through The Winds and the Willows to Alice in Wonderland and all sorts of European novels.
Sure. Ernest H. Shepherd, who did the original Winnie the Willows and also was the Pooh illustrator, was an influence. Arthur Rackham, a student of Arthur Rackham's named Edmund Dulac, was someone I studied. More currently, there's a gentleman named Tom Port who lives here in Michigan as well, and he's done a couple books dealing with Native American myths, but also anthropomorphic characters. I really like his work, and when I found his work late high school, early college, is part of what was pushing me in the direction of doing children's book illustration, was that I found somebody currently doing the kind of work I thought I could do, that felt in the right tone of my artwork.
Mm. And you mentioned Michigan, and you come from Flint, Michigan, which in the UK is probably only associated with Michael Moore. So we have this kind of notion of a poor town where you get stuck in the car industry and there aren't many options. But actually, is there a thriving art scene that we're not aware of over here?
There is. I mean, Flint was, I think, unfairly portrayed in that movie to sway audiences into ticket to GM and what GM had done to his family and to his own career and everything. So there is an element of truth, obviously, in that it's a very working class town. There's a lot of, you know, car industry jobs. Most everybody I grew up with, their dads had something to do with the car industry at some point. But I went to high school in what was known as the Cultural Center.
Mm.
And the Cultural Center is this really gorgeous campus that includes the main branch of the Flint Public Library, which was a, I don't know, three-story building. It was huge. Right next door was the Flint Institute of Arts, Flint Institute of Music, Bauer Theater, which was a theater for local theater groups to do stuff, learning and the arts. And oh, there's a planetarium there that at one point was the largest planetarium on the east of the Mississippi, like up until the mid-70s or early 80s or something. It was still known as a fairly impressive planetarium. So, yeah, there was this big area in town that was kind of understood. We value these things other than just the blue collar.
Mm.
And there was always a good undercurrent of appreciation for the arts. The middle school, or the elementary school I went to, was known as a creative arts school, and we had art and music year-round, which I guess even when I was going to elementary school was becoming more and more of a rarity, with school arts being first on the chopping block. And then I had art classes in middle school, and there were mural programs going on in the school, and even more so in high school.
Mm.
And the high school that I went to was part of what they were calling a magnet program, where various high schools were known for different having different strengths. And if you were in the magnet program, if you were one of the kids that excelled at school, you could choose where you wanted some of your classes. So you could have your math and science classes over at Math and Science High School. And my home base high school was the Arts and Humanities.
Okay.
So there was just this this really nice undercurrent. I still know people who are living in Flint who are active parts of that scene. A good friend of mine is involved in the theater community, and he just did a play, and he said it was with the, and now I'm going to screw it up, but the Flint Theater Troupe or something like that. And I said, I've never heard of that one. You're always doing shows with the Flint Community Players. And he said, well, there's Flint Community Players, there's the Kersley Park Players, there's the, and it just listed off about six different groups. And he said, I've done stuff with all of them. And I was like, really? There's six different theater groups in Flint, really? And he said, yeah. I said, is that out of necessity? And he said, yeah, there's that much going on. Different venues, different people, different types of theater, different audiences. I went, wow, Flint, Michigan has enough need for six theater groups.
Well, have you been back to talk to your alma mater?
I have. I've been back to my community college a couple times. And then also there are actually five colleges in Flint. Moffitt Community College, and then U of M, which is housed in Ann Arbor, Michigan, has a couple satellite locations. And Flint is probably the largest of those.
Mm-hmm.
I was just up to speak at U of M Flint for a comic book class. So yeah, I've been up to Moffitt several times, and then also over to the U of M campus.
It does seem that there's a bit of a renaissance of anthropomorphic comics happening at the moment. I don't know if it's because both the media seems to be so saturated with superheroes that almost people are getting sick of it. So actually these older forms of comic book storytelling are suddenly becoming popular again. Anthropomorphic comics seem to be very much an American art form, going back to things like Pogo Possum, and then in the 80s and 90s, things like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Yosogi Ojimbo.
Yeah. I mean, I think it might be coming around again a little stronger, but in a lot of ways it never really went away when you look at Turtles and Usagi having been popular enough to have a consistent title for the last 25 years, I think. Mm. At least for Usagi, I know, they just celebrated the 25th anniversary. So in that way, it's kind of weird to say, like, yeah, it's back, because Stan's been busting his hump for quarter century.
And he did a pin-up for you, which is reproduced in one of the hardback books. Was it was he one of your heroes that it was a pleasure to get in touch with?
I didn't read a whole lot of Usagi growing up. I was more familiar with the Turtles, and that was kind of my book. A buddy of mine read Usagi more. But, I mean, Stan's a legend in the industry, and he's just so good at turning out a book, and a quality book. He has an amazing work ethic, and he's an amazing guy. Just the sweetest, nicest, most down-to-earth, level-headed guy you'd want to meet. Like I said, Usagi's a good book, too, so you can't beat that. He was really cool, yeah. I met him at a San Diego, and he came by and told me that he had picked up the book before and that he thought it was doing well. He thought it was cool that Mouse Guard was out there. And then he said, if you ever wanted to do a pinup exchange, just let me know. So that was that. It was relatively easy. Mm. So, I lucked out on that one, but he was already a fan.
Cool. The US publisher of Mouse Guard, Arkea, is a company I hadn't really heard of until I started buying Mouse Guard. Had you taken the comic to various publishers before finding one that was happy to publish it?
They were the first people that I showed it to.
Oh, really?
I had done a self-published issue one that I was just selling at the local convention here in Michigan. And that was in May of 2005. So May of 2005, I'm setting up at this very local, small convention selling print-on-demand copies that I had made. So that there wasn't a whole lot of profit margin to be made. It was more about seeing if this whole thing would work. And if it did, I'd go on and print issue two. I'd use the profits from that to print an issue two, to draw and print an issue two. And then I was at San Diego walking around, just, you know, it was my first time at San Diego, just trying to soak up what that big convention is like. And I had copies of Mouse Guard with me, and somebody said, oh, or it's somebody who knew me here from Michigan, said, are you shopping Mouse Guard around to publishers? And I laughed in their face. Who on earth would want a book with mice about swords? You know, Marvel, I'm going to go to Marvel and talk to them. They're going to be interested in that. DC is going to be interested in that. And the guy said, well, no, not those, but there are a lot of independent publishers, and you could try somebody like Arkea, who's looking for unusual fantasy content, not your run-of-the-mill stuff. And I was like, oh, okay. And then he mentioned that Mark Smiley was president of the company at the time, and I had actually talked to Mark about trying to get a portfolio ready to do maybe some role-playing game illustrations or style illustrations, and Mark gave me a really good portfolio review and was really kind. So the idea of going and showing somebody this silly book that I was working on, this thing that I liked, but a publisher wouldn't, didn't seem as daunting. I could go talk to Mark about this. And right away, Mark wanted to do business. One of the first things he asked was about the format, if I'd want to keep the format. And I said, yes. And he said, good answer. That's the right answer. He said, that's the right answer. I thought, oh, that's cool. The publisher is actually encouraging me to keep this unusual format. That's like, not only are they interested in my book, they also want to keep the format. That's unusual and promising. So I figured, as long as I'm on a roll here, I'll ask for one more thing. I said, can we keep the publisher information, like your logo and everything, off the front cover of the book and put it on the back with the USB code? And it was also like the USB code and just all the stuff that can kind of start to clutter up comic covers. And he said, yeah, that's not a problem. He said, as long as you're doing wraparound covers, I don't mind putting everything on the back.
Cool.
Since then, we've put things back on the front and just made it small and not so obtrusive, but all those things combined. He was interested in the book, he wanted me to keep the same format, and he was willing to move his company's logo to the back of the book to make room for more of my artwork. I thought, this is the company to go with.
So. Well, and now they're publishing Fraggle Rock in landscape format as well, so maybe you're influencing a change in the way that comics are being produced.
Yeah, well, Arkea told me straight up, they said, we want to do this, but we don't want you to think that we're just trying to use like the mouse guard format to do anything. You know, like we're not trying to take something from you. Mm. And I said, no, I think it's great. I really like this format. I like working in it. I think working in a square is more interesting than working in that tall rectangle. Mm. Works better for the kind of panel arrangements I certainly want to do. So yeah, I think it'd be interesting to see some other stuff. They were interested more in branding it with the idea of it being all ages friendly, like mouse guard. Mm. And true all ages, not just for kids of any age, but adults as well, real all ages. So yeah, they were cool with doing it. It also helps that Strathmore had approached me, the paper company, had approached me about doing some cover art for their comics line of paper. And after I agreed, I said, oh, by the way, on a side note, can I get some quotes for you guys trimming up pads to the size I work in, which is 12 by 12. I'm buying sheets that are 14 by 17, and I'm having to trim down by hand, and it eats up a lot of my time. So could I get a quote from you guys for trimming down some paper? And they said, oh, we'll just make it part of our comics line. And I was like, no, that's not really appropriate. I'm the only guy really doing square comics. This was before Fraggle Rock. Mm. And they said, no, that's fine. If you're doing it, it means that there's a comic out there that exists in this format. Mm. And I was like, well, okay, I'm not going to argue with you guys. If that's what you want to do, that's what you want to do. So, yeah, the Strathmore came out with a comic paper that's in the square format, and then Arkea releases Fraggle Rock, and there have been a couple other square books. And then there's also Stuff of Legend. And I don't know that I necessarily, made them do that kind of format or influenced them as heavily as it might seem, but I think Mouse Guard, having been a square book already out in the market that's doing well, with at least an easier route with their publishers to consider as an option. Mm. But they could see that there was already a test market.
Well, it's interesting how even the format of a comic suggests something about the contents, that we get so used to superhero-sized comics being associated with superheroes and adventure comics that when you see something in a different format, it suggests immediately that it's going to have something different in the interior. And of course, you're also talking to the history of children's picture books and the way that, for example, newspaper strips like Garfield have often been reproduced in squarer, more landscape formats.
Yeah, I had looked at other things. I mean, the way I got to have wanting a square book came out of wanting to have something that instantly looked different sitting on my table at a convention. Now, it was several steps in between how I initially kind of got there to want it to stand out, and then why I ultimately went with it was that I liked what it did to panel arrangements. I liked that it forced the horizontal for panoramic images. I liked that the emphasis wasn't on these tall, kind of skinny panels. And there's a balance, because they're the same height and width as a square book. There's this kind of like Zen balance you can have to other square panels and how they fit on the page. Mm. And what they do with the rest of the remaining space. So I had looked at other books too, like books that had just gone landscape, the exact same dimensions as a regular comic, just landscape. And it didn't feel right in my hands for the most part. I always felt like you either put the staple on the long end of the paper, just like a regular comic, but you've drawn everything, rotated 90 degrees. Mm. And you kind of hold it in your hand when you're reading that and flipping it like a calendar. And it's just not quite comfortable in your hands. I think that's taking the reader out of the story more than it's immersing them in it. And then I've also seen the ones where it's that landscape format, but the binding is on the edge, on the short end. And that only really works, I think, when you're talking about like a hardcover or like a Garfield collected trade or something like that, where it's thick enough that you can kind of hold the whole thing. But for an issue format, the paper's just so long and it's kind of bendy, and holding in your hands is just awkward. Mm. The book doesn't support itself when you're holding it with one hand. So I thought the square was a really nice balance of those two things.
Mm, definitely. Originally, Mouse Guard is published as individual comics and then collected in these hardback editions. Were you looking forward to the collected version when you started doing the serialized one?
No.
Okay.
I'd never drawn a comic past 10 pages just with friends.
Right.
And so I had set up at a convention and people had seen Mouse Guard images and stuff because I had it as a concept, not knowing what I wanted to do with it. If it was going to be a children's kind of book or a prose book with spot illustrations, or if it was going to be something that I'd write up as a screenplay and try to get a movie made of it, or if I was going to do my own stop motion animation, or, you know, whatever. I had no idea how to present Mouse Guard to the world. And then people saw the Mouse Guard stuff and responded to it. So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to, next convention, I'm going to be back. I'm going to have a comic book. I'm going to use Mouse Guard because I already know that that's the thing that people responded to the most and I have the most amount of development for. And I did what started as a 20-page comic, and then I padded it out, or maybe it was even less than that, maybe it was 18 or something. And then I padded it out to be a normal size issue, leaving a bit of an open end as to where I would go next. And so that's fall issue one. Mm. When I approached Mark at Archaea and he asked, you know, so what comes next? How many are in this series? And I just spouted off. I just said, I mean, I knew kind of where I wanted to go with that story and where it would probably logically end, but I had no idea how to calculate that in number of issues or whatever. So I just said, yeah, it's a six-issue miniseries. Thinking, yeah, 6 issues is respectable. It seems like enough to warrant doing a comic series. It's not like I'm saying 3 issues or something like that. It seems substantial enough, but at the same time, it's not like I'm setting myself up for a 10-year commitment or something ridiculous where, you know, I'm never going to see the light at the end of the tunnel. Mm. So, yeah, I just came up with that number, 6. It sounded right. And then once I got a grasp on how to tell that story in 6 issues or where to end the story or where to put in the right kind of pivotal moments to keep the swing going all the way to the end, 6 just became the magic number. Mm. It became what I was comfortable doing. So we've continued with that.
Which obviously then works well with a bi-monthly schedule in terms of, you know, a yearly end-of-season story arc.
Yeah, the bi-monthly came up more because of how long it takes me to do an issue.
Right.
We just knew there was no way to do this on a monthly schedule unless I had more than half of the thing finished in advance. So Archaea was also growing at that point. They were relatively small, and I don't think they had the capital to be able to print monthly books to sustain themselves. They needed to kind of space things out, like, okay, we're paying a printing bill every 2 months instead of every month. So
yeah,
it all worked out well. I prefer the schedule.
Mm.
If I was just a fan of Mouse Guard, I probably wouldn't prefer the schedule.
Well, in a way, because it leads to these yearly collections, it's kind of like people could also get into the schedule of buying a Mouse Guard hardback once a year as a Christmas present for themselves or someone else.
Sure. Yeah.
What is the kind of process that you go through? It seems like it is a comic that's done in a traditional way, that you pencil it, then you ink it, then you add color. Could you talk a little about that process?
I start with some kind of text, generally an outline of where the issue needs to go. All the major bullet points of what needs to happen in that issue. I'll put tick marks next to each bullet point, kind of figuring out how many pages I think it would take me to tell that part of the story. And sometimes that's just a gut reaction. That's just a guess. Mm. Other times I'll actually start planning some things out in my head, saying, oh, that would definitely take 3 because I want one of those pages to be a splash panel. It's more of a big reveal, and then one page in, one page out. Yeah, so 3 pages for that thing. So I'll put all the tick marks on my outline, and at the bottom of the outline, tally them all up, and hope that I'm at my magic number per issue, which is 23. If not, I'll go back and start correcting and making notes about why I shortened something or lengthened something. Hmm. And then I work off of that outline as a guide for how many pages each kind of scene is. And sometimes I'll go in and start writing dialogue immediately for some of those scenes. Other times it's purely what my imagination comes up with for the visuals. I'll do sketches in my sketchbook of elements of that scene and figure out if the panel should be a vertical panel or a horizontal panel, kind of the shape of things. How am I going to fit this all on one page? So I'll just do all these sketches, not even in a panel layout, just, you know, with Kellanoff swinging his axe. Can I draw that vertically, or do I have to draw that purely horizontal? You know, how can I come up with the body shape or what panel shape is going to fit the body shape the best. And try to lock onto whatever the most important panel on any scene is as being the one that I can't change. I have to draw this panel in this shape, and then I'll try to fit everything else in around it. So, yeah, I'll do all those sketches and then scan my sketches into Photoshop, be able to resize, rotate, sometimes do some corrections, like if I've drawn a hand too big. Instead of erasing in the sketchbook and then trying to redraw that hand perfect again, I'll, in Photoshop, shrink it or enlarge it or rotate it or whatever it is I need to do to kind of get it back in proportion with what the rest of the drawing is. Assemble all those pieces into a file that's a page layout. Mm-hmm. Make sure everything fits where I want it to. I print that out. I'll put it on the light box with a piece of Bristol over it and either do tighter pencils using my sketches as a guide, or if my sketches are tight enough, I'll just start inking right on the page. And I'm adding, that's where I'm adding a lot of the texture, the kind of shading, the stippling, the cross-hatching, all that kind of mouse guard line quality stuff comes in the inking stage. The original art, once I'm done with the page on Bristol board, gets scanned into the computer, and then I color everything in Photoshop.
Cool. Because it does seem that certain aspects of mouse guard are very much identifiably you now. There's, you know, you could almost say that there is a Peterson crosshatch. And it's interesting the way that you talk about it being a mixture of the physicality of still drawing on a piece of paper and then tweaking it in Photoshop. So obviously you're very happy with both the traditional ways of making art and the way that computer manipulation makes it easier to create a final image that will look good on the page.
Yeah. I'm a firm believer in, just like in movies, there's time for CG effects and there's time for practical effects. And it's the directors who can blend both together that end up making the best effect movies, at least in a modern days. So with mouse guard subject matter, I want to make sure that the computer work never comes through as looking like computer work. You know, it would be too jarring to the tone of what I'm trying to create in mouse guard, but to deny its power as a tool, I think would be silly. Embrace it. At the same time, abandoning traditional, I think you'd lose a lot of the charm that mouse guard has.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
The recording of the interview in this podcast was facilitated by Audacy Technology via their iPhone speakerphone attachment, the South of Market Dock. More info about which you can find at www.audacy.com. That's audacy.com. For more info about David's comics, please visit his blog, David Peterson, that's peterson.blogspot.com, where there's info about the next serialized issue of the Mouse Guard comic, a prequel called The Black Axe, or to find out more about the British hardback editions, please go to www.titanbooks.com. And over the next 2 weeks, I'll be podcasting longer edits of my interview with Jim Medway and the group discussion with Gary Northfield, who in the podcast is also joined by his studio mate and colourist, Ellen Lindner. You can download these podcasts, plus all of the shows I've recorded this year, on my blog, www.panelborders.wordpress.com. In the meantime, American cartoonist Erica Mohn, author of the hilarious and frank autobiographical title Dar, which she describes as a super girly top secret comic diary, will be in London for the opening of a gallery show at Orbital Comics. Come along and see her paintings in real life and get a book signed. That's at Orbital Comics, 8 Great Newport Street, London, WC2H7JA, on Thursday the 30th of December from 5 p.m. More info at www.orbitalcomics.com. the broadcast version of Panel Borders, we'll be back on Resonance FM in January. Thanks for listening.